Hi, this is David Sweet, CEO and founder of Focus Core Japan. And if you are like many of the APAC leaders that I speak to, you're struggling in Japan to find the right talent. You get bombarded with irrelevant resumes or a lack of resumes altogether. I would like to invite you to discover the power of Focus Core's retained search. Let Focus Core help you swiftly secure top-tier talent in this candidate short market. I'd like to invite you to shoot me an email and explore how we're different, and with 100% refundable trial, we can revolutionize your hiring process today. Now on to our podcast.
We've changed over the last 3 years our methodologies to be the best of class of hiring senior executive talent. And we have an exceptional team that you've built up. And I think it now allows us not only to recruit executives in Japan for APAC companies and global companies, but to also do a little bit extra, which I'm super excited about, which is, helping with branding, helping companies do better messaging, process improvement, and consulting around all these things.
Welcome to the Focus Core podcast. For this podcast, we're mixing things up, and I am your guest host. My name is Simon Jelfs. I'm Focus Core Japan Managing Director, originally from the UK. We decided to turn the tables for this podcast and make Dr. David Sweet our guest. David is originally from Denver, Colorado. He has 25 years recruitment experience in Japan, all of it in leadership roles. He established Focus Core Japan in 2011. He's a father of two, a keen runner, a writer, and a ukulele player. I found it quite hard to say ukulele. Welcome, David.
Thank you, Simon. You nailed it.
How's it going?
It's fantastic.
Excellent.
Are you?
Yeah, doing
how's
good.
How's it to be on the other side of the table?
Yeah, this is my host debut. So let's see how we go. I've got a list of questions ready to ask.
Oh, very exciting. So
I'll start with a soft one. Are you ready for the Moria Marathon, which we're actually running on Sunday?
Totally ready. Absolutely. So I'm going to be pacing you. So the question is, are you ready to be paced?
Yeah, I'm ready to go. I've completed my training and I'm looking forward to a fast time, hopefully. Fast for me anyway.
Woof.
So, David, why do you run so much?
That's a great question. My first answer was my first answer is Simon. So, back in the day, I growing up, I was never an athlete. And when we started working together, that's when we decided that healthy salespeople are better salespeople. And so we all started getting healthy, and I decided to run. And I'd never done anything athletic growing up. I was had two left feet, terrible hand-eye coordination, and but I found out running, all you needed was a pair of shoes, and then the consistency to go out and do it over and over. There was just a mental toughness aspect to it I really liked. And I liked the competition with myself. And you got me out running. And I find that the reason I run so much is that I the older I get, I still realize that my best times are still ahead. Last year I hit PBs in the 5K, 10K, and half marathon. So I'm just... Yeah, and just enjoy running and improving upon what I already do.
Excellent. And I think you recently won an award in one of the runs you did recently, right? Didn't you receive a trophy in the mail or something?
Scuba 10K. Scuba Marathon has a full and a 10K. And I participated in actually the half. It's a half, right? and
participated. 10K, I think. Yeah, 10K? Scuba 10K. 10K. Yeah.
And I came in fifth.
Fifth. Fantastic.
So I got an award for that. Yeah, I was totally surprised. I had no idea. They sent me an award. I got a nice little plaque and yeah.
Excellent. Something for the trophy cabinet.
Absolutely.
And then you're heading to Barcelona in the spring to do the Barcelona Marathon. What's your target time for that? And tell us more about the Barcelona Marathon.
My goal is just to finish. But my second goal is to hit a PB. And then my best time is 3:09. For the last few years, I've been hammering away trying to run a sub-3. So that would be my ultimate goal if I could do that, if it's all the stars align. But I think it's a beautiful race. I love running in Europe, and Barcelona is a gorgeous city. It's a flat course. It's in springtime, which is important to me because I don't train very well in summer with the heat, which is the reason we decided to run scuba, which I've run scuba marathon several times and crashed and burned several times. And so decided, let's just do half marathons in the autumn and work on speed and then do the A races in springtime.
Excellent. Our listeners will be supporting you.
Yes. Well, by the time this comes out, maybe we'll have the results in the show notes.
Excellent. So you're, in my view, you're a man of action, and you're a front runner in many ways. So, you know, with business, you're always looking to innovate and do things like the Focus Core podcast. You're writing books. You're learning the ukulele. You're always excited on Fridays about what you're going to do at the weekend, and they're things that you want to do as opposed to passive things, for example, watching something. That's how I kind of see things. So my kind of key question to you is, how do you stay motivated? Because you do so much.
Great question. I guess, like, for running, it's easy because I have a race on the calendar. So I'll finish up a race and I'll make sure I have two or three to look out for. And I think in life, I like to try lots of stuff. I just think it's fun to be an amateur and fail at lots of things, and some of them stick. The other thing that I find is to select very, very small tasks that I can succeed in. So for an example, if you're going out and you decide to go from a couch to 5K run, I don't recommend you go out and do 5K. You're better off going out and doing a run walk of 1K and doing that five times a week and building up that habit and the consistency. Sometimes in music, if I'm playing something that's super hard, it might be that day I'm just working on four notes, and that's okay. And I think, you know, finding small things to do, it like the podcast starting up, you'd mentioned, it was like, okay, well, what do I do? And let's record something and get it out there and start fixing it as we go along. So I think those are, you know, have a big thing at a race at the end of it, try many things and try the small tasks that you can succeed early on.
Excellent. Yeah, I think the key thing I notice with you is you don't hold back in getting started. So you're always quick to start.
Yeah, well, you're going to fail, right? And so you might as well start. If just keeping it in your mind is a dream and a wish, and nothing will come of that. We spend so much time planning, and life just goes by while you're making plans. I think John Lennon said that in a song somewhere.
Yep.
Yeah, just think, yeah, you go out and do it. Okay, and get better at it as you go along.
Excellent. So next question. So your answer might be incredibly long, given my previous question, but what are you excited about for the next 12 months?
Yeah, sounds cliche, but I'm really excited about helping companies in Japan. We've changed over the last 3 years our methodologies to be the best of class of hiring senior executive talent, and we have an exceptional team that you've built up, and I think it now allows us not only to recruit executives in Japan for APAC companies and global companies, but to also do a little bit extra, which I'm super excited about, which is, you know, helping with branding, helping companies do better messaging, process improvement, and consulting around all these things. Whereas so much of the time we used to spend just recruiting, we never got to really go in deep with a client and sit down and work with their leadership and fix the cause of the challenges instead of just, you know, putting a Band-Aid and hiring someone. I just think so often talent acquisition teams or senior management don't know how or what to do in Japan and to hire.
Mm.
And it's not that they don't want to do the right things, and they know that it's difficult to hire in Japan, but they realize that there are better ways of doing it. And so that we're able to guide clients. I think that's the next 12 months. That's what I'm uber excited about.
Excellent. And on that, so how do you think Asia Pacific or maybe head office leaders outside of Japan perceive the Japan market at the moment?
That's a great question. So I think there's two opposing views. One, Japan's an enigma. It's still a black box, and they know there's no idea how Japan works. And then there's the second idea that Japan isn't really that different or difficult. It's just that it's being messaged that way. So leaders try to force success rather than buy in and partnering and believing that the company, whether it's the Japan and HQ, Japan and APAC, they're all on the same team working together. And I think it's really opening up that communication and trying to first understand instead of trying to force something to happen. So I've just speaking to, you know, people in HQ or APAC leaders, I just feel that they either have no idea what's going on in Japan or that it's just very difficult, and they believe in what their Japan counterparts are saying. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, totally. That makes sense to me. So, it's almost, it's like two camps, right? So the Japan is different. I don't get it versus, well, how different can it be really? Right. How hard can it be for a like very sort of practical example? Well, you know, how many candidates are we actually meeting in a month? Well, let's just get started. Kind of similar to what we were talking about. Let's meet candidates that are in the market and understand the market. Yeah. So like in terms of headaches, if you think of headaches, what kind of headaches are you solving for Asia Pacific clients?
I think what the headache that we're solving is that of the two viewpoints that we're talking about, that we're the lifeline of communication between Japan and APAC or HQ. And we are giving them what's really going on in the market. And oftentimes we'll sit down to lunch with folks visiting from HQ, and they're saying, what's really going on? And they're breaking out of their ivory tower and really wanting to know the truth. So, and frankly, many leaders in Japan also don't know what's going on. They're happy just to stay within that ivory tower. So we're meeting leaders in Japan all the time, and we've been doing that for nearly three decades, right? So we have a pretty good idea of what the truth and what's fiction and what information is important to really make a company succeed within their talent acquisition.
Mm. Excellent. So in terms of, like, if you're an APAC leader and you want to improve your business's recruitment performance in Japan, what do you think are some easy wins that could be implemented? What advice would you give around that?
Yeah, it's a big question. Some easy wins for APAC. Employer branding, both internally and externally, I think is number one. You know, explain over and over again why you're to your employees why your company is a great place to work, and then explain it consistently on social media, and then have that messaging pushed down locally. So often, Japan wants to do a lot more branding on social media, but they're handcuffed with only HQ can do some of that branding and some of that marketing. So I think going more local with that messaging. I believe if you're a company that is growing, and if you can on social media, you can advertise that you're growing, and because of that you're always looking at hiring people, then you can post jobs on Japan on LinkedIn and always be posting jobs and always be meeting people. I think that's an easy win. I hear a lot of companies buying job slots, but they don't need to. They can, you know, if they have, a lot of these business leaders have very good social networks. And if they just dropped in their social network once a month, once a week, you know, what positions that they're looking for, they would get people applying to those. And this doesn't cost any money. This is just a bit of time and consistency. Another one I've always a big proponent of is for having a database. And then forcing your team to use it. And by using it, it's not just opening up a job on a job portal, but actually having a CRM team that your talent acquisition team uses to regularly reach out to people that have applied for positions. And, you know, maybe have newsletters that go out once a month that advertise what's great about their company and what they're doing. And sometimes this doesn't need to be any different than some of the marketing that they're already putting out. They just need to feed that into a CRM that they're pushing out to potential candidates. So if someone's applying and they know they're good, stick that in a database and earmark that this person might not be good for a CFO position now, but they could be good in the future. And two more ideas that pop into mind. One is figure out what your core jobs are and be great at hiring those, and then outsource the rest. For example, Apple is great at hiring marketing and salespeople. Their talent acquisition team will not be beat. They'll give jobs to recruiters in marketing and salespeople, but if they feel like they're getting beat if they hire from a recruiter on those two areas. So their team just goes out and maps the market and knows the market for sales and marketing. They get a CFO role, they call us, right? They just outsource. It's not in their core area. And then I think that carrying on with that to the next thing I would say is partner with a recruitment partner and to trust them to fill your senior confidential niche positions.
Yeah, great. Thanks. The one you mentioned about, you know, companies having their own kind of CRM and, you know, like keeping in touch, you know, with candidates kind of proactively and like managing the relationship proactively. What do you think the reality now is on the ground? Like, how many companies do you think are actually doing that at the moment?
Yeah, it's less than we like to think. So I was working with a large American retail company, and they had 8 people doing talent acquisition. They had a great CRM system that was brought in from New York, but they still did everything on Excel.
Mm.
So every new position was put on Excel, and it was put on someone's desktop. And if that person quit, then they've lost all that information. They had the CRM system, but they weren't trained, and it was just kind of laborious and not Japan specific. So they didn't use it.
Mm.
And it's surprising how many large companies are still using spreadsheets. And for SMEs also. And so I think there are some really good solutions that are bilingual. They're simple and easy to use, and they don't need to clog up the recruitment process. Hire Planner comes to mind. But companies like Apple, again, going back to them, they have a great CRM system. They don't use a portal, and they don't for recruiters.
Mm.
And they don't use that to clog the system. They use it to generate help. So I think it's not as many companies as you would like to think in this day and age. And there's some cheap solutions out there.
Yeah, that's my gut feeling too, that mostly the portals or the CRMs, they're mostly around internal compliance and internal data management rather than proactive sort of management of passive candidate relationships, right?
Hmm.
Yeah, interesting. Changing themes a little bit, what advice would you give to someone taking their first C-level role in Japan?
Well, that's a great question. An easy one is just to network like crazy. Just as if you're, if it's your first C-level role or your first time as a business leader in Japan. So sometimes we do a lot of searches for country managers coming into Japan. We bring people in from outside. I would say that they should, you know, right away join a chamber and at least one other networking group and really get to know senior leaders, competitors, and vendors.
Mm-hmm.
I just know the market as quickly as possible. I work with, do executive coaching for a lot of mid-managers. That's the area I really like to work with.
Mm.
Mid-managers are very well skilled and they're very competent. However, they haven't learned to network both internally and externally.
Mm.
And I find that that's just when these leaders start seeing the power of doing that, it accelerates their career for these mid-managers. And I think most of the time you meet C-suite people, that's what they're very good at.
Mm.
What do you think? What would advise?
Yes, tough question, right? I think the networking side's important. I'd say the just trying to understand what's going on. So just the assessment piece, right? So just in the first 3 months, really just asking a lot of questions to really understand internally about the business, right? So how are things? Why are things as they are? Really understanding all the details of the business without making any judgments, right? I think it's very easy to come in and want to change things very quickly and make an impact very quickly and really mess things up.
Yep.
And then, yeah, but then on the other side is you can also be too passive, right? And you can just be, you know, people are watching, thinking, well, when's he or she going to start doing things and stop asking questions? So it's kind of a bit of a balance, right?
What we do, it reminds me of, you know, when you were talking about what leaders can do, APAC can do to hire better. I'm a proponent of having a good recruitment system in place, having a process in place.
Mm.
And when we work with companies to put in a process, whether it's top grading or some other process, the first thing is to go in and study what the process already is. You don't go and just willy-nilly put a process on top of and force everybody to do something different. You got to work with what's already there and then organically start to best practice it.
Mm.
And it's minor nudges versus, you know, just wrenching something out. So I think that first 90 days is a similar thing where you just don't go and wrench things right and left quickly unless it's a turnaround situation, company's going down, you have to, but.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. Depends on the situation. And then in that first 90 days, I think that's kind of where you come across maybe the most of, you know, what we mentioned at the start of the podcast, where it's the, you know, Japan is different, where as the leader, you're getting told how different Japan is from your employees, maybe. And then it's, as a leader, then that's like how you process that and what you decide is the reality.
Yeah.
That's like the start of the adventure, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And then generally speaking, how would you say your leadership styles changed over the years? Because to my knowledge, you've been in recruitment leadership roles since the late 90s.
Yeah. And before that, I was in management positions. And so I think the big thing is learning. I don't think it's anything dramatic. I think most leaders learn that the more comfortable they get with managing, and then you change your leadership style and you start feeling very comfortable delegating and understand the power of working with people to get things done and not making mountains out of molehills, because you've seen the molehills go into mountains and you know that that doesn't work anymore. And I think it's just that kind of wisdom that comes with age. Nothing dramatic, I don't think.
Mm. Yeah, because if you think about the work environment now, compared to how it was in the 90s, I'd say things have changed quite a bit, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we used to have faxes, and our mobile phones weren't with flip tops, and we'd look for jobs in newspapers.
Yeah, and I remember having very big computers, and. and us all having sort of landlines in the office, and being able to call each other on the office, like on the office line, right? So, yeah, kind of different days. Whereas
it's changed quite a bit.
Whereas these days, phone calls have become a bit rarer.
Yeah, we were told. I heard someone this week say, "Would you please?" Schedule calls with me. Please send me a text first. And that's kind of more the norm than the exception nowadays.
Yeah, definitely. Calling people out of the blue. I mean, for me, in terms of like hiring and training employees in their 20s, you know, encouraging them to do phone calls, which for me, yeah, was maybe second nature because of when I started doing it. For them, it's a really, really scary, weird, behavior, which they're not used to.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. And then what would you say are leadership skills which are required these days that were not required 20 years ago?
I'm going to answer this question a bit differently, because I think it's important to focus on leadership skills that have been required for all of time that keep you relevant. So that the skills that will help you 20 years from now or 100 years from now, I think are still the same. I think there's three things that are super important. First, dedication to self-improvement. That keeps you relevant no matter what changes around you. And along with that, I would put in curiosity. If you're going to be a great leader, you're dedicated to self-improvement and curiosity. Number two, energy. Great leaders have a lot of energy. They don't say that they're busy. They don't say they're tired. They get up early. They're enthusiastic. They're passionate about life and work. And I think the third thing that leaders need to be comfortable with is ambiguity. Things change all the time, and you have to be comfortable with things changing all the time. There's the pandemic. Great. Now what do? Let's do something different. Mm-hmm. The economy goes up, the economy goes down. You got to be comfortable with that. You got to be comfortable with new technologies, with people changes, with anything that might come along. And it's just being comfortable in ambiguity and just thinking, wow, that's interesting too. Let's flourish in that as well. So I think those are the three things that are required 20 years ago. They're required now, and they're going to be required 20 years later.
Yeah, so they're ageless leadership skills or leadership behaviors, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I 100% agree with that. Especially the ambiguity one of just change management, right? That's always there. There'll always be some kind of change going on in the background. And I see things as being like cyclical. They're being cycles to everything, right? So yeah. It's like being able to understand the cycles.
With that ambiguity, however, it's knowing that there's no right answer.
Yeah.
It is having an appropriate answer for the time you're in and the cycle that you're in. And it's that appropriate response to challenge is the thing that historians like Arnold Toynbee and Will Durant have praised civilizations for ages. And I think that's what leaders need to be doing. They need to be stepping up and making the correct answer for the time that they're in.
Mm. What was there a time as a leader when you thought you had the answer always, if you sort of look back?
Wow. Yeah, probably. The challenge I find is being a leader from the front, like a general who wants to be in the front of the army.
Mm.
And that's not always the best place to go.
Mm.
I always think, that's where you got to be. Let's be in the front. Let's be the pace setter. And you'll lose people in the back that way. You'll get shot that way. It's not always that way, the best way to do it. And I think that's the answer when I was in my 20s and 30s leading teams. Definitely. I was like, okay, let's do it my way and let's go fast. And
yeah. Yeah, I think so, right? I think that's something we've all been through. But yeah, you don't ever want to be too far from the front either though, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
There needs to be some balance. Changing gears again. This one's a toughie. What's your favorite restaurant in Tokyo?
That's not too much of a tough thing. There's a couple of my go-tos, but I like Tanakaya in Ginza. They have fantastic soba. I like the management team there. It's always great food. Interesting clientele in the evening sometimes. And, you know, not only soba, but they have, you know, some great dishes. It's just always a good time to go in there.
Excellent. So what do you normally order when you go in there?
Ooh, if I'm going in with a client, I'll tend just to get maybe a tencero soba. So, you know, maybe just soba and also a bit of tempura. On the weekends, if I go in, or in the evening, I'll get tamago yaki. So kind of a big, very nice. They have some skewers of beef with onion, kind of a yakitori type of meat, which is fantastic.
Nice.
And they have a delicious sake that I highly recommend as well.
Excellent. I'm looking forward to trying that place out. I think I have been there before.
I'm pretty sure I took you there. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Excellent.
I've got, in fact, I think today I posted a Scott Smalley and I having lunch there. Well, and we went with Felix as well. I think last month, probably three or four clients were pictured. I got pictures on LinkedIn and
yeah, I remember. Yeah. That was, last quarter of the year last year, right? With Felix. Yeah.
Yeah.
Excellent. Nice. And then what would you say is the best race you've ever run in and why?
Ooh, okay. Can I give you three?
Yeah, why not?
Three different categories.
Yeah, why not? Let's go.
So Paris, I love Paris. I think Paris is probably my favorite. If I had to say one answer, Paris is my favorite marathon. I did get a PR there. It's a beautiful course, well-supported. A great city, so it's just so much fun to run. I loved running Rome. It's a slow course, a lot of turns. It's like over 70 turns, but you feel like you're running through a museum. It's a gorgeous, gorgeous run. Highly recommend it. And in Japan, the best marathon, my favorite in Japan happens to be Kobe. I think Kobe. Okay. was one of those kind of quiet runs. It's well supported again. You're running along the seaside. Also some great food. I really enjoyed Kobe.
Excellent. Is there a big field in the Kobe Marathon normally?
Yeah. Yeah. Pretty big field too, but it's a smaller field than say Osaka and Tokyo. Yeah, definitely a much smaller race.
Well, what time of year is it normally?
I think that's in spring.
Okay. Very good. Hopefully I get down there one day. I've never been to Rome. I would love to go to Rome. Not necessarily to run a marathon, but I'd definitely like to go to Rome.
It's a nice way. It's a nice walking tour. You get to see the whole city.
Yeah. Well, that is the great thing about running, right? Yeah. If you want to get your bearings, if you want to get to know cities and places, you can't be running.
Yeah, I like going out when we travel. I'd like to go run, and the only city I've ever gotten really lost in was Venice. I had to ask people three or four times how to get back to my hotel. I just got so turned around in that city, which is why they built the city that way, so armies couldn't invade them. But most cities are pretty logical how they're laid out. Venice just, wasn't that way.
The question just came into my mind, did you try and run on water when you were in Venice?
No, but I got to go to St. Mark's Square, and it was, 5:30 in the morning. No one's there. And so it's just this, I have photos of this completely empty place that's usually inundated by tourists, and you get to see that in the early morning and no one's there. It's brilliant, absolutely brilliant.
Another great thing about running.
Yeah.
Excellent. And then what are the best shoes you ever ran in? You wrote an article about running shoes.
I did.
Very recently. So I feel you're very well prepped for this question.
So currently, my current love is I got a pair of Nike Streakflies, and they're I use them for my speed work. and for short distance runs. And it's just nice cushioned shoe. So I really like putting them on. I ran a 100K race in Skechers and didn't have a blister at all, but they've changed them, how their models work now. But when they came out, Skechers were underrated and performed well. And I think for the 7 marathons in 7 days, you know, they sponsored that run to Fukushima, and they had a pair of shoes in the mix as I ran up, and they were nice enough to give shoes to orphans. But I ran that in Nike Pegasus as well. Those are kind of those are a workhorse shoe, pardon the pun. Yeah. But the Pegasus tend to, even though they change models every year a little bit, they tend to be pretty standard. And after they started making their shoes a little bit wider for Japanese feet, which my feet are similar to, they were a good shoe.
So you mentioned then running a 100-kilometer race and then running 7 marathons in 7 days. Why would you do that?
The question actually is, why wouldn't you do that?
Hey.
The 100K race, actually, you know, after most marathons, at about 35K, you're in pain. And you just want someone to jump out and say, you know, shoot me. Put me on my misery. And I, after the end of a marathon, you think, I'm not going to do that again. After a 100K race, I thought, yeah, this was fantastic. I'd do this again. But after about 50K, you're in pain, but you kind of get used to it. And it settles in. And it's a different mindset. It's a long, long game, right? And the 7 marathons in 7 days, that was, you were out there for some of that. And it was just wacky and fun, because it's not a race. It was going out and just really being out on the road.
But how do you get up? So like, you've done 3 marathons like back to back. So for example, on the fourth morning, how do you motivate yourself to get your shoes on and run another marathon?
It's on the calendar. I'm kind of an A-type personality, and my running coach Harrison says that even for A-type personalities, I'm an A-type personality of A-type personalities. So it's
got it. So it's planned, so it must be done.
Yeah.
There is no way out.
No. Yeah. But actually in reality, it was just fun. I didn't mind. I really enjoyed waking up and doing that. I was prepared for it. I really enjoyed it, everything about it. I was glad the last day. So after 7 days of that, I actually ran up to the orphanage, which was only, I don't know, 15K, 20K, something like that. But I was kind of, I was glad that was done at that point. And, but I'd like to do something similar in the near future.
Yeah. What's the next challenging running project? Don't pick something too hard and really, because once you say it, then I realize you're going to do it. So,
well, you know, I was talking to, Knights in White Lycra, our buddy, Rob.
Rob.
And when I had this idea to run, my original idea was to run to Kyoto. And Rob's like, well, I don't know anything about Kyoto, but we have a bike ride to Fukushima, so I can help you do that. So that's why we ran up to Fukushima. Kyoto would be one I'd like to run, you know, from Tokyo to Kyoto. And I have a dream to run from Kyushu up to Hokkaido in springtime and follow the cherry blossoms.
What do you mean, from Kyushu all the way up to Hokkaido, actually run it?
Yeah. The most southern tip to the most northern tip of Japan.
Interesting. Like, how long do you think that would take?
I've kind of calculated out different routes and dates and ways to do it. I think it would take probably 3 months to do.
Okay, so a quarter. Yeah.
So
that really scares me. Yeah.
That might be a workcation that I'm on the road. Because you go out and you run 4 or 5 hours, 6 hours, and then you go and do some work. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I guess you can do that. Yeah. How about Tokyo to Kyoto? How long do you think that would take?
I think it can be done in less than a week. Week.
I think it's a long drive down to Kyoto, right? From Tokyo.
Yeah. It's longer than Fukushima. But I think if you go at it 60, 70K a day.
Yeah.
And kind of mix up the speeds and the distances, you could do it.
Cool. Well, I'd be more than happy to support you in a support vehicle with four wheels.
Get your bike out, mate.
Yeah, I could put my bike in the car. Excellent. And then when is your next book being published and in which languages?
Oh, geez, that's a good question. Well, it'll be in English. Because no one's taken, we're going, Sweet Sales was translated into Chinese and I wanted to translate in Japanese and just never got it done. But the publishers did the Chinese version of it. So that was helpful. But the next book, I'm aiming to have it published in 2025 because I got the contract with the publishers said that I got one more sweet success series out. And so I've got drafts floating around on the internet somewhere that I'll get done.
Cool. And how about ukulele? Have you got any ukulele plans?
So I've joined the Sweet Strings Ukulele Orchestra. Isn't that an awesome name? I had to draw a name like that.
We see what you did there.
It wasn't me. Hey, they just, they named it. They've been around for a long time. They're having their 10-year anniversary performance in Osaka in April. So I'll be performing with them. It's a great orchestra. They have probably about 40 people from Osaka, Nagoya, and Tokyo. They have not only ukulele players, but guitar, bass, mandolins. It's a great, great group of folks and fantastic. And they named it after me. They didn't even know they were doing it.
Excellent.
Sweet.
Yeah. That really will be sweet. One idea that just came up is you could run down there with your ukulele, but yeah, don't commit to it because I know, don't mention it because I know if you do mention it, you will actually do it.
I'll start thinking about it. There's possibilities there, right?
Yeah. Good. Well, I think from my side, that wraps things up.
How was it to be on the other side of the table asking questions?
It was different. It was very different being a host. Yeah.
Great host.
I'm looking forward to doing it again. Absolutely. But yeah, it was kind of hard because I kept thinking, oh, what's the next question? Where is the next question? How do we go from here? But yeah, I think it worked out okay.
I can hear a rugby podcast in your future, Rugby Dad.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that actually. Yeah. Yeah, I think that may happen. I'll have to try and get some rugby guests on the Focus Core pod.
Oh, brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
We'll see if we can do that.
Well, thank you for coming up with this idea. I loved it. It was fun to do and be on the other side of the table.
Excellent. Thank you. Now I'm doing the uptown low down, yeah.